Hello, and welcome to Volume 148 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss fire districts that send tax bills despite a state law banning the practice. We'll discuss using drones in your forest management. We'll talk about squirrel hunting, and we'll talk about the Biden administration's plans to consider eliminating the stepped-up basis. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page, and you'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you'll face as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our first guest is Garrett Watson. He's a senior policy analyst at the Tax Foundation, and we've heard that the Biden administration is considering eliminating something called stepped-up basis. A lot of people are concerned about it, so we've asked Garrett to weigh in. Hello, Garrett.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Tell us how this proposal impacts landowners who have a capital gain that's built into their asset.
Right. So right now, landowners who have a capital gain who bequeath that land to someone who's inheriting it, that capital gain is adjusted so that there's no tax that's owed on the part of the person inheriting that land. And the Biden administration is proposing, and Congress is debating, whether they want to tax those unrealized gains, many of which are in land, upon death. Which, of course, would be a pretty big shift compared to the current law. They're still debating the various exemptions that might exist there. The Biden administration has proposed exempting the first $1 million in capital gains that are unrealized, $2 million for those who are filing jointly. And above that, you might be subject to tax on your unrealized gains when they're bequeathed. In addition to that, of course, they're also proposing to raise the rate there. And both of those, of course, may result in a pretty large change in your potential tax bill when those assets and then that land is being bequeathed. I think that's a couple of different impacts. One, of course, is there's a liquidity concern, right? Folks may not be able to have the cash on hand to pay this tax if that gain is built into land and not in a liquid asset that can be easily used to pay the tax. And the concern there is that could be a barrier to folks being able to pass along their land to folks who are inheriting it, especially if that land is being used productively in the context of a business. And so that's one big thing. The second big thing, of course, is figuring out your basis in property. Sometimes that is straightforward, but if you have land and you've had over a long period of time or sometimes even multiple generations, that can take some time and work to figure out. And so hopefully we get some more details on how folks will be protected if they don't have that information, and get more details as this legislation continues in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Well, having to pay a capital gain at death is different from having to pay it at a sale. And there's a sale, there's a liquidity event. There's money that's realized, and that money can be used to pay taxes. But at death, there's really not a sale. It's just a transfer, you know. And so that strikes that time period very hard. Has this thing ever been tried before? And if it has, what can we learn from prior attempts to change the way that capital gains are treated at death?
Right. So Congress has looked at this a couple of times, most notably in 1976. Congress tried to move to a similar tax change where you would carry over your tax basis at death. So the person inheriting your land would have your basis and owe the capital gain when they sold it, which is a bit more incremental than the change being proposed now. That didn't actually take effect in the long run. It was actually repealed by Congress in 1980 because there were a lot of concerns both about liquidity and determining your basis over if you hold that land over a long period of time. And there's a lot of worry about the administrative problems related to this. So even though Congress passed it in 76, they ended up going back to the current tax treatment by late 1979. The second attempt to change this, it was a messy situation, but basically in 2010, there was 1 year where the estate tax was suspended and folks could elect to move to carryover basis. But that only lasted for 1 year, and that was also by 2011 shifted back to current law. And I think those two experiences do underscore the fact that these are tax changes that are going to be hard for taxpayers to swallow if they don't have that liquidity and don't have the information needed to pay the tax. And so we're watching this closely to see where this goes. And if it doesn't happen, we still might see a rate hike. So it's very important folks follow that as well if they're looking to realize gains in the next couple of years.
Okay. Well, thank you, Garrett. We appreciate that. Our next guest is Jessica Little with Larson & McGowan. She's been assisting landowners who continue to receive bills from rural fire districts for dues despite legislation banning this practice. Hello, Jessica.
Hello, Hayes. Good morning.
Tell us a little bit about your experiences in dealing with these type of fire district bills.
Well, we first were alerted to the bill that passed in 2019 through the Capital Ideas newsletter. So we started looking in 2020 as the bills came in, and especially in Mobile County, we saw some up to $250 per parcel. We saw them in Montgomery County, Jefferson County. When I called the Mobile County Revenue Commissioner's office, I was told that they receive an electronic file from the volunteer fire department with the parcels and the liens to be imposed. So basically, they were saying it's not up to us. We get these files. I argued that it's on the Mobile County bill, so they should have control, and there was now a state law. After going round and round, I eventually sent a list of all of our clients and their parcels and the fees that were imposed. A few months later, we finally got a refund check for all of our clients and the fire taxes that they were that they paid. Jefferson County told us that it wasn't to go into effect till 2021, and Montgomery County really gave us no clear answer. And even the odd thing, and even the refund letter we got from Mobile County referenced the refund was because of the legislation. So 2021 comes around, our bills still have a fee from the volunteer fire department. It looks like it's typically $70 and it's itemized on the bill. We have also seen them on Jefferson and Montgomery County bills that are coming out right now. And Hayes, our firm handles property taxes on 9 million acres of timberland in 25 states, so we see how other volunteer fire departments handle their fundraising. They send newsletters. They send requests for donations. Sometimes the bill comes directly from the fire department, and some it's listed on the county bill, but as a voluntary contribution that the landowner can add to their property tax. So we just it just seems like Mobile County is kind of passing the buck. They sent a letter this year with their bill that said, if you have questions on the fire tax, to please call the volunteer fire department. That is misleading to me because it's on a Mobile County bill, and we all know if your tax bill is not paid, you can have a tax lien. So I would just encourage landowners to check your bill. Check it online as well as the paper copy, because we did see last year some counties listed a fee, but then when you went to the website, it detailed out a fire fee. And call your revenue commissioner. Send them a copy of the legislation. I think it's on the website. So I would just encourage everyone to ask questions.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good advice, Jessica. Thank you for that. We appreciate it very much.
Mm-hmm.
IMV Forestry is a leader in chemical and mechanical vegetation management, all designed to help a landowner achieve his management goals. We're pleased to welcome Corey Craig to discuss the use of drones in vegetation management. Welcome, Corey.
Good morning, Hayes.
What role can drones play in the forestry industry?
Well, drones, or technically named unmanned aerial systems, are still relatively new to the forestry industry, but the technology is advancing fast. 10 years ago, if I'd have told a forester that he could cruise his timber with a drone, he probably would have laughed at me. Today, it's hard to find a consulting forester that's not actively using drones to at least get a bird's eye view of the timberlands that he manages. On the larger side of that, you've got the TMOs that have built entire drone divisions and currently employ or contract numerous drone pilots to conduct all kinds of services with drones.
What are some of the services that your company can provide that relates to drones?
Well, first and foremost, we perform herbicide applications with agricultural spray drones. We have found several niches where the drones outperform common methods of herbicide applications. And typically when we first approach foresters, they think we're trying to compete with the helicopters. That's just not the case. Drones are simply a tool similar to a carpenter's hammer, a saw, a square. Our drones provide another tool in the arsenal of foresters, a belt to, you know, control their vegetation management needs. Secondly, we've developed a device that creates a GPS address of each seedling that we plant. We're using drones with those GPS locations to go out and do survival audits and tree inventories in years following plantings.
Give me an idea of who your typical customers are and what their experiences are in using drones.
Well, we typically contract with a broad network of consulting foresters, private landowners, and several of the largest timber managers in the country. We have a pretty broad footprint pretty much all over the Southeast, and we're performing applications today wherever we need to go.
Okay. All right. Well, Corey, thank you for that. We appreciate your participating today. David Strickland writes for Great Days Outdoors. He recently wrote an article about squirrel hunting that caught our eye. Hello, David.
Good morning, Hayes.
What are some of the reasons that people squirrel hunt? A lot of deer hunters out there, but not as many squirrel hunters.
That's absolutely true. Most people look at 1972 as when squirrels kind of got out of fashion, if you will. But up to then, they were hunted by most everybody in our culture, especially the state. But first and foremost, I'd like to throw out there that they taste delicious. They are the end game here is to provide a meal. But they're really good. But unlike deer hunting, where you can go for weeks before really getting a chance to make a shot, bushy-tails offer excellent chances for success most any day that you venture out there. They're just everywhere. They're underutilized resource, really. You can use many tactics. It doesn't take a lot of special equipment.
What benefit could a young person particularly have in going squirrel hunting?
Well, it's the mentoring side of it that that I really focus on. With a couple of grandkids, I've really got to put it in practice. But hunting small game is a great learning experience, whether you can leisurely walk through the forest and you can talk, unlike deer hunting, and the wind doesn't matter, and as long as you're not yelling, it's okay. But you can answer questions, look at various plants, insects, animals, tracks, trails. It's a great opportunity to explain the importance and value of a forest in general, and trees in particular. And it's also the perfect opportunity to learn about various tree species, and the side benefit is you get some fresh air, a little exercise, and it's a good bonding experience for a new hunter or a kid. And if you will, along with just maybe bringing home a few squirrels for supper.
That's one of those many things that's kind of a means to an end. There's a lot of things that can happen during a squirrel hunt, including hunting squirrels.
Oh,
so what's the best squirrel gun for people who have not participated, for young people?
Well, I would say a 410, but they've kind of gone out of vogue. It's difficult to find ammunition. But without a doubt, a youth model, especially for a kid, a 20-gauge with a good soft recoil pad in modified or full choke. Right behind that, I would put a bolt-action 22 or a Ruger 22, an automatic, but you can save a lot of ammunition with a bolt-action with a young kid. They fire one shot at a time. I would like to also throw out there that the best ammunition for a 22 in short range up to 50, 60 yards is a CB cap. It's a very quiet round. It's almost like shooting through a silencer. The range is also safer. The range is, it kind of drops off after 70, 80, 90 yards. It just kind of dissipates in its energy.
Mm-hmm.
Great round, especially for urban hunting.
You've talked already a little bit about what young people can learn, but what can grown-ups learn when they're hunting with their children?
Well, first and foremost, patience. I'll tell you, a kid out there in the woods, they're just all over the place looking and questions and everything. And so patiently answering their questions and kind of guiding the conversation, if you will, and pointing out things and kind of just using it as a teaching moment. But by dedicating a block of time to a youngster or a new hunter, hopefully it will result in a greater appreciation for nature in general and the forest in particular and the role of trees and their importance to our state and to wildlife and to the big picture, if you will.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, David. We appreciate that.
Sure.
And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Garrett Watson, Jessica Little, Corey Craig, and David Strickland. Inflation is not something that we've had to reckon with for quite some time, but it appears to be rearing its ugly head again. In particular, the rising cost of energy and fuel is a major concern. This affects forest owners in every way imaginable, both directly and indirectly. Its effect is indirect in higher prices for every product, including the products that forest owners provide. Higher prices mean weaker demand. Its direct effects can be seen in rising costs for fuel for the various machines and harvesting and management. These extra costs can get passed on to the owner of the forest. Inflation acts like a tax increase. It lowers disposable income. So it's worth keeping an eye on inflation and promoting policies that keep it in check. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.